Okay, this is sound roll number 45 for Fight in the Fields, a paradigm production of the minus E to be referenced and to follow in the module on energy equals zero view.
Gloria next door.
Okay, this is going to be the interview with Herman Gallego. It's the 30th of August. We're starting on camera roll 93. Our first take will be take one. That's what's next.
As they call sal si puedes, which means get out if you can. But I think a lot of us who got involved in the movement, whether in 52 or 62 or whatever, really have to say that we've been part of a continuing struggle. A struggle that was involved, involving our parents, our ancestors, our people in this country to overcome the devastating impact of economic poverty, even though we were very rich in culture and values and family support, is that nonetheless discrimination, racism has taken its toll on many generations. So it wasn't that we started in any particular period, it was really a continuation of where our family ended and we picked up. Now, I was working in a gasoline station in East San Jose, right near in Sal Si Puedes, and I was also going to school at San Jose State University, which was all previously called San Jose State College. A brilliant young organizer by the name of Fred W. Ross, who had been organizing in East LA, talked about the Zoot Suit Riots, the Bloody Christmas incidents, how the CSO, Community Service Organization, was organized to fight racism, discrimination, as well as to develop political empowerment. Fred talked about how Ed Roybal, ran for city council after World War II and lost. But when the voter registration program came into being, the Roybal election resulted in his being the first city council person in that city in 70 years. And that was the result of voter registration. So as Fred Ross talked about ways by which communities can empower and organize themselves, it was suggested to Fred that he organize in Sal Si Puedes, and that's how I got involved.
And one of the other people who got involved early on was a guy named Cesar Chavez, and you and he started building what would be a CSO chapter there in San Jose.
Yes, I think we...
We'll pick up with that.
This is take two. You good with something?
Yeah.
Marker.
Okay, so we were talking about meeting Caesar and you and he starting to organize what would be a CSO chapter.
Yes. I mentioned that Fred W. Ross was a brilliant organizer who helped to provide the know-how to those of us who were concerned about improving the well-being of Hispanics in Sal Si Puedes. He was then working with the Industrial Areas Foundation, which was started by the late Saul W. Alinsky, who started IEF in the back of the Arts Council in Chicago. And Alinsky would tell us these stories about how he brought together community groups to help overcome the adversity in those neighborhoods. And so with support from the American Friends Service Committee and other groups, Alinsky was able to piece together a budget for Fred that allowed him to spend this time in East San Jose. One of the first things he did was to organize house meetings where we'd have 10 people at a time that would go to a house and Fred would stand up and talk about what had happened in East LA and talked about a vision of how we could do the same for our communities. That's where I met Caesar, and I remember Caesar living in a very tiny house where Helen and the kids lived, and Caesar had a sofa in the front room and linoleum, no rug in the front room, and very tiny kitchen, a big double bed, and then lots of cribs. The streets were unpaved, no street lights. Caesar lived smack in the middle of Sal Si Puedes. Some say Sal Si Puedes got its name because of the economic poverty. Some say because the streets were unpaved, if you didn't get up in the middle of the night, you got stuck and your car wouldn't move. But nonetheless, as part of this organizing period, we did voter registration work. And I remember meeting Caesar for the first time. He was a lumber handler. And he had this warm smile. And he had a gold tooth that always seemed to show up. And he had very expressive eyes. And sometimes he'd give away himself by his eyes, a moment of surprise. And other times, if he did something or thought he should have done something or something happened, he'd say, golly, you know, that was something that he would shake his head and say, golly. But in our first meeting, I think he had a very deep-rooted suspicion of middle class. I was one of the few folks who had a college degree, and I hid that as much as I could, primarily because I think Alinsky and the organizers taught that people who are affected by problems should be the ones helped to organize and be empowered to change this. That you couldn't have middle-class social workers going into the barrio to assume the leadership role in place of the people affected. And ironically, I was just a very young man with a young new college degree, 22 years old, and Caesar was a few years older, and very inexperienced. And I remember the first time we got together to practice our speeches, we were nominated for, I was nominated President Caesar, first vice president of the new Sal Si Puedes CSO chapter. We went over to my house, we stayed up till 3 o'clock at night practicing. I was practicing my Spanish, Caesar was practicing his English. And finally I said, Caesar, we just can't go on all night, let's just say what we have to say. The next night, the auditorium was filled with about 500 people. Jose J. Alvarado, who was a radio announcer, and his candidate was Joe Flores from Robert Hall Clothiers, announced the fact that new leadership was going to come into being, and they nominated a slate of officers that were very well known. I got up and made my speech. I got my nomination of Caesar, and we won. And after that, we were so happy and surprised, and Fred Ross said, well, why are you surprised? We said, because we've never run for office, and certainly the speeches on the other side were better. And Fred very calmly said, yeah, but who's been doing the work, the voter registration work, for the last 6-8 weeks? Who's been going door to door? Don't you think the people really know who the workers are? So I think that was a very important organizing principle that Caesar and I learned, that you really didn't have to promote yourself, that it was by doing the work that the people really developed the confidence in you. And I think that was an important lesson for us.
Let's talk a little bit about those continuing the early days. Caesar really plunged into it, and he obviously felt that this was what he wanted to do. But it really wouldn't have worked if he hadn't had Helen behind him. Talk a little bit about what she made possible.
I think the hardest thing for anyone involved in the movement is being away from home. The sacrifice you make when you have very little money and you put it into the car to drive people around to get registered. And Caesar was a lumber handler, but not always working on a continuing basis, so he was unemployed a great deal of the time. And there were times when they had very little, and yet Caesar continued to persevere. And Helen and Caesar's family, mother and father, brothers, sister, Rita, brother-in-law, all were very supportive of him. And Helen particularly, it really stands out. I remember one year when we were registering voters, and it was getting on to dusk, and we ran across a preacher from a church.
Yeah, let's stop. We'll pick that story.
It's a very important story.
Yeah, it's a good one. Okay. But we are close to the airport.
Okay, that was take two.
Okay.
Take three is next.
If this keeps up, we'll shut the airport down. I'll put in a call to Mo.
We have a neighbor who is just...
Rolling. This is take three, marker.
Let's pick up with that story. You're registering voters late.
I think one of the early examples that I witnessed that showed what kind of a strong support system Caesar had from his family, but particularly from Helen Chavez, happened one Christmas Eve some years ago, around 1952, when we had been out doing some community work, and it was getting on to dusk, and it was about time for us to return to our homes, and one of the ministers from a local church spotted us and asked us if we wouldn't mind distributing a few Christmas baskets, boxes of food to people. These boxes were left over and thought that we might know someone. We said, sure, we'd be happy to do that, although we're not in the giving game, that is, of Christmas baskets. But we said we'd help out. So we went to one home, and they took the box eagerly. We went to several other homes, and either no one was home or they had already had a box, and so time was getting on. I felt the pressure to get home. It was Christmas Eve. And so I drove to Caesar, and we were still talking about who should be given this box. We pulled up in front of Caesar's home, very tiny little home, very modest home. And so I said to Caesar, I know. I said, you take it. I mean, you're not working, and it's Christmas Eve, and I'm sure you could use it. He said, no, I can't take it. I said, Caesar, look, I know you haven't been working. I know you can use the food, and there's not that much anyway, and besides, you know, Helen can use it. So we went inside, still arguing about this, and Helen was, this is Christmas Eve, there was no Christmas tree, no turkey, no pies. There was, Helen invited me to have a bean burrito. I said, yeah, sure, but I've got to get going home. And I looked around, I said, Helen, I said, you know, we have a box of food there. I really think you should take it. Caesar doesn't want to take it. Helen smiled at me and looked at me, looked at Caesar. She says, you know Caesar. And I said, but you've got to. And so Caesar and I resumed the discussion. And he said, look, he said, you know I can't take it, and you know why. And I thought about it. And he said, you would too. You wouldn't take it. And then I remembered, I said, you know, you're right, Caesar. Even though I would be the only one who would know that you had taken the basket, you would always feel uncomfortable that somehow others or I would know that we had taken something that maybe should have gone to someone else more needier. And I said, you know, you're right, Caesar. I said, well, let me go over to La Señora Bojorquez, who does a lot of door work with her church, and give it to her. And that's what we did.
You going to change film now? That's a good story.
Okay, that was take three.
Is that the end?
Yeah.
That's the end of camera roll 93. We're going to 94 now.
We had to talk strategy, and we were going to go to a meeting. And Caesar, I asked him, as usual, how's Helen and the kids? And he was telling me about one of his daughters who was going to have surgery. I said, when? He said, well, tonight. I said, Caesar, I said, don't you think you should be there? And he said, we really have to do this. I said, but Caesar, don't you think this is more important? He said, it is more important, but on the other hand, I've got to do this. I mean, this was an incredible commitment to community that some people may never know about.
That's quite strong stuff. Now, let's shift gears a little bit and go back earlier. You also knew Ernesto Galarza.
Yes.
Who was a very significant figure who was trying to organize. Talk a little bit about Galarza and what he was trying to do in the 40s.
If we look at the 40s and the 50s and up to the 60s, this was not a time of great compassion for farm workers or for social justice. We certainly, in 62, with the New Frontier and the various initiatives that Kennedy and Johnson placed on equal opportunity, that there was change. But in the 40s and 50s, Ernesto Galarza was unsuccessful in organizing a national farm workers organization simply because organized labor wasn't there, there wasn't the commitment of the Congress, there wasn't the there weren't the resources there. And we found that Ernesto's had a difficult time in getting materials published. His books on spiders in the house and about agribusiness were very hard to get published in those times. It was very, very sad that a person, the genius of a Galarza, was not able to get read and published as easily as he would, because it was Ernesto who talked about the evils of the agribusiness. He talked about the system and of the Bracero system, which led us later to defeat the Bracero program based on Galarza's analysis. One of the groups that was most helpful to Caesar and to all of us in that early point of the movement was a group of young men, priests, organized into what was called a mission band. When I first heard it, I thought that was an orchestra, but it was a band of priests who got together to provide advocacy in Mexican-American communities in the rural valleys of California. Unfortunately, they picketed once too often, and particularly with a lettuce strike in Imperial Valley, and they were subsequently disbanded by their archbishop. But it was to Father Don McCullough, Tom McCullough, Don McDonald, John Dugan, Ronald Burke, Jerry Garcia, John Garcia, Father John Garcia, that really were helpful in tempering Caesar's views about how to approach organizing of farm workers. It was these men that provide the mentoring and the tutoring that helped Caesar to understand very clearly what had to be done in order to organize.
Well, were these a bunch of people who believed in the social role of the church, or are you saying that they had a profound religious influence on Caesar?
I would say both, but primarily the...
I need a whole sentence. I would say this group of priests, so we know what you're talking about because we don't use my question.
The mission band had both a religious and a social influence on Caesar. First, in terms of the understanding about the problems of agribusiness, interpreting the work of Galarza, for example, interpreting the role of the encyclicals, which were not purely religious terms. I remember, though, on the social stuff, that I don't know how much of that we picked up initially. I remember parking in front of Caesar's home a number of evenings with Father Don MacDonald, and he would ask us, "Do you have your rosaries?" And we would say, "No." He would pull out some plastic beads, and then he would proceed to lead the rosary, and each decade we would offer up our prayers for the organization to help the poor farm workers and so on. By the end of the first decade of the rosary, Father MacDonald was sound asleep, and Caesar and I would be sitting there wondering what came next, and then Father Don would wake up, we'd go on from there. But clearly, the religious influence did reach Caesar. And in fact, there were some who probably even criticized him when he was having the fast as to where the symbolism played into the basis of helping to organize. There are some people who don't feel that that should happen. There are others who felt that Caesar was a genius in using political religious symbolism as a way of attracting people into the organizing process.
And that's particularly appropriate when you're working with Mexicans.
Well, it seems to me that we have to be both culturally hospitable, we have to be sensitive to the religious temperament of communities. I think, though, to assume that all Hispanic farm workers are simply Catholic isn't true, but I have to say that in the early years, the Catholic Church played a very, very important role. In later years, of course, Chris Hartmeyer and the Protestant denominations were helpful to Caesar. Josephine Duveneck from the American Friends Service Committee and the Quakers, the Friends Committee, were very, very helpful to us and to Fred in the early beginning. So I would say that in an ecumenical sense, there was a great spirit of desire to help the unorganized.
Let's switch gears again and move up a few years. You and Caesar had worked a long time in CSO. In 1962, there was this moment where he broke, and I'd like you to talk about the 62 convention and what you remember.
This was a very painful time for us. The organization had now clearly moved to the point where there were many folks in the organization who felt that we should pay more attention to the increasing numbers in the cities, certainly 80% of Latinos now living in the urban cities, and the crying needs of unorganized farm workers who, left to their own devices and to traditional union organizing, would never be reached. Caesar's experience in Oxnard in Ventura County, where our Farm Labor Committee reached something like 1,300 members, showed that farm workers could effectively be organized. We thought that perhaps turning this over to Helstein and to the packing shed workers might succeed in offering an institutional union a base by which to go forward, but they clearly didn't have the internal capability and expertise or vision that Caesar did. And by this time, there was this tension within the organization between those who felt that we should spend more attention to one base of constituent interest or the other. And I remember in the Imperial Valley, and I believe it was in Calexico, we were meeting, and Caesar was giving a report, and Maria Duran Lang, who's passed away, got up to speak, and she was criticizing Caesar and referred to him just simply as an organizer. And Helen Chavez was sitting to my right, and I thought she was going to leap from her chair to the front and smack Maria. But I said, "Helen, let me handle it." So I got up and I defended Caesar. But I think it was at that point, the handwriting was in the wall, and it was at that point that I left the organization as well. And it seemed to me that the CSO had served a very important purpose, not the least of which was to empower 44 neighborhoods and communities throughout the state. And if you look back to that era of its legacy, it wasn't just Cesar Chavez. It was Dolores Huerta, there was Cruz Reynoso, there was Gil Padilla, there were people in the labor movement, Tony Rios and Gill and others, that today in many instances are still active in the movement. So as a training ground and an empowering mechanism, it worked. Clearly, we achieved things like helping to increase registration of Latinos. We achieved old age assistance for non-citizens. We dealt with local neighborhood issues. We had to deal with the McCarran-Walter Act. We had to deal with McCarthyism and the fright of communism. But clearly now we had moved into a state, a regional, and national arena. And at this point, the organization had that challenge. And Caesar, recognizing the organization could not become a farm labor union and was not about to adopt farm labor organizing as its main menu, decided to leave.
And went his separate path. And from then on, as he started building a group that worked with farm workers, what he did really affected Mexicans in the cities, though. Didn't it become a sort of an inspiration for other people?
The 60s was a time when all Latinos were trying to provide or to gain some visibility on the national scene that, unfortunately, people in Congress viewed us as a regional population without recognizing that in the Midwest and right around Washington, D.C., there's huge pockets of Hispanics, and yet we were seen simply in terms of a regional people. There was a walkout against the EEOC in Albuquerque. There were other things that were happening on the Hispanic scene, part of which was to demonstrate that we were here as a people with specific problems that need to be understood, that unlike the American understanding and grasp of slavery in America, there's very little sense of understanding about what was happening to Latinos and Hispanics in the Southwest and in the country. And Caesar, through the farm worker movement, through the Peregrinación, the march from Delano to Sacramento, and the fast, brought national attention to a group called farm workers and then to this dynamic individual.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to start over there. We're going to change film again, and I think we have to change take two.
Okay. That's the end of take four and the end of camera roll 94 and the end of the sound roll too. Goodbye.
We'll start at 40 times.
Just, yeah, a couple times it was faint, but not a problem. Okay, this is sound roll number 46 for Fight in the Fields of Paradigm Production. We have a minus ATP reference tone to follow on the modulometer, which equals zero VU. Okay, this is the continuation of the interview with Herman Gallegos. We are starting camera roll 95. Our next take will be take five.
Enter this march. Why didn't he enter into this boycott? Caesar gave it almost international visibility. The other was that in the cities, there was a sense of frustration that unless you rioted, in the case of Watts or Rochester, that you really didn't get any attention. And there was always this tension between a movement that was headed toward violence and a movement that was going to be nonviolent. And at the point of 1968, when Caesar went on the fast, we felt that this was so helpful to some of us who were involved. I was by that time with organizing the Council of La Raza. And we had a sense of danger because there was Corky Gonzalez and his movement in Colorado. There was the Reyes Tejerina incident. There was the situation that was in the Carson City Forest. There was the incident, Jose Angel Gutierrez talking about eliminating the gringo. There was the time of the Black Berets and then the Brown Berets and so on. And all of that created tensions because there was a push for militancy and a push for organized change. What Caesar added to it was a dimension of nonviolence. And I remember in 1968 writing, along with Henry Santiesteban, a pledge to nonviolence in which we warned that violence would destroy far more than it creates, that we should use Caesar's example to how to demand change, and we would have it, but we should not be trapped into returning violence with violence. So Caesar, I think, within our own community, presented a voice of reason and consciousness that said, look, I'm not saying don't be militant. I'm not saying don't be proactive. All I'm saying, let's not kill ourselves in the process of doing this. They may kill us, but let's not try to match the opposition with guns. And so this was a very, very valuable lesson to us.
Let's go back again to the early 50s to meeting Caesar. Do you remember the first time you met him and what your first impressions, how he struck you?
somewhat shy.
I need a whole sentence. When I first met Caesar. Right.
When I first met Caesar, I believe it was at a house meeting that Fred Ross had organized, and remember shaking hands, and Caesar had a rather anemic handshake. Later, when we got to be good friends, I said to Caesar, "Caesar, you have to change your handshake. It's like handing somebody a cold fish." I said, "What you have to do is to grab their hand, look them in the eye, and shake them." I said, "If you notice what some of the politicians do, they not only shake you vigorously, but they grab you by the elbow and say, 'Good to see you,' even if they don't know your name." And so the first handshake was rather anemic, but I do remember Caesar's smile, his suspicion, as I said, of middle-class professionals. And I was certainly, I wasn't middle class, but I was at that point, I had a college degree, one of the few. But over years, we had fun. And I think that one has to look back at their experience. As Galarza said, you can't change your history, but you can learn from it. And Galarza also said that the best kind of history is that in which you've had a part in shaping. And to think that we had a hand in shaping so much of that early part of the movement with somebody as just as great and noble as Caesar, obviously leaves me with many wonderful memories.
Back to Galarza for a minute. Galarza, and even before him, talk a little bit about what happened in the 30s and 40s when people tried to organize, and why you think it didn't work then. What were the problems?
The problems of organizing any group, whether it be farm workers or urban poor in the cities, was in part a factor of a struggle between capitalism and labor. I'm a product of Southern Colorado, where we had the great coal field wars in Ludlow, and a struggle between the Colorado Fuel and Iron and the miners, and many of whom were killed when they established a tent city and were massacred. And I think the resources for organizing just simply were not there from organized labor. They were more concerned with industrial workers and urban workers per se, in auto and machine and steel. The foundations, the philanthropic community, didn't even know that Latinos existed. There was no outside income of resources to help people to become organized. There was, as I mentioned, very little in terms of national compassion. There was, I remember in 1952, a Harrison Williams study on migrants at a time, I think, when Harry Truman was president. We were just delighted and thrilled to know that there had been hearings on the problems of farm workers. There was very, very little done by way of research and information.
But back in the 30s, it really did have aspects of what we might call class warfare. The communists were active in the fields, and it really was
class warfare.
Polarized, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. We had no idea how big and how powerful agribusiness was in those days, how they subverted the use of the Department of Labor to deal with the Bracero program, to provide a managed care system of workers to work in the fields. Carrie McWilliams tried to expose some of that. Galarza tried to chronicle that, but he couldn't get published. Again, most of the efforts for helping the farm workers were met brutally and unsuccessfully. This doesn't mean that the organizers were less brilliant or committed. It's just that it was not in the cards in terms of the country's commitment to helping the underclass of this country.
Now, you know, history goes in cycles, and the farm workers really came together as a movement in the 60s and 70s, but the 80s were a very hard decade for them and labor in general. Yes. What do you think happened to the farm workers in the 80s?
Well, number one, I think there's a valuable lesson, and again, Ernesto Galarza wrote about this in his book. He talked about the fact, warned us of the danger of organizing around the compassion of others, that compassion can be temporary and soon run out, and without that you have nothing. And to some extent, the 60s was a time of great compassion for the poor and the underclass in this country, and that was one reason why Caesar was able to get a lot of volunteers and help. The other thing that Galarza warned about was the danger of organizing around charismatic leadership. He felt that charisma is a one-time, one-person thing, and when that person is gone, you have nothing, unless you have built a movement. And so there was always the concern that what Caesar was doing was very heavily weighted around the charismatic aspects of his style and his leadership, and others concerned about negotiating the contract, the organizing of a hard and fast union discipline, which required his being there more than he was outside. I'm not criticizing that, except to say that it was very easy to know that on the one hand, his great contribution was he brought the public attention to the farm workers and to the poor. The other was, did he really organize the farm labor union?
Because a lot of people in the movement were conscious of that process, the fact that they needed Caesar to fulfill a symbolic role, but that that had some problems.
Yes, the notion again of charismatic leadership, and I think that Caesar would be the first to tell you, because he's a product of the organizing period of the Alitsky and Fred Ross principles, that you really have to empower individuals and groups and communities, and that the individual per se is not the basis for the organized. And I think Caesar understood that, and I often wonder sometimes how Caesar felt being propelled into the limelight, as famous as he is. I know that there were times that he would say, golly, you know, this was not something that he wanted. I remember a story that I can tell you about a young 10-year-old that was helping me do some gardening, and I asked him what he was learning about Chicano history in school, and he had obviously learned nothing, including the fact he knew nothing about the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo or Juarez and so on, and Benito Juarez and so on. I was a little exasperated. I said, well, you have heard about Cesar Chavez. And I said, I'm not talking about the boxer. And he said, oh, yes. I said, I'm talking about Cesar Chavez, the farm worker organizer. He said, yes, I've heard of him. I said, well, great. I said, I work with Cesar. You work with Cesar Chavez? I said, yes. Then he looked at me. He said, hey, I have a question. I said, what? He said, how come he's famous and you're not? And it seemed to me, and then I said, well, the Lord works in mysterious ways. And I think that for us, this was the first time that we in our Latino community had a figure that we could look to, not to represent us, but to epitomize the best of what is good in our community. And I think Caesar certainly did that. And I think Caesar would be the first to say, look, this was not about my getting onto the front page of the New York Times or on any of the network news. It was about my commitment of service for my community.
Because on one side he's a symbol, the other, are we out? Okay, just a little roll up. On the other side, the movement is created of all these thousands of people, right?
Yes. A movement, it seemed to me, must reflect the contributions of the people whose names we'll never know. Clearly, in the early beginnings, I remember Mrs. Sofia Bojorquez, who belonged to one of the Pentecostal denominations. She was our best voter registration person. She would go door to door. Or Johnny Torres, who was a barber. He would register everybody who came in, and if they weren't citizens, he would help them to become citizens. There was a Juan Marcoida who helped run our CSO radio program, CSO en Forma. Ran that for 3 years as a volunteer, giving information to the about cancer community affairs.
All those people, right?
That's the movement. You know, Caesar and others played a significant role that symbolized, you know, the movement. But it has to be the little guy, the little woman, the person in the background. That's what the movement's about.
Okay, that's the end of camera roll 95, and that was take 5. We're now going to camera roll 96. Our next take will be take 6.
Kevin, we were talking about the fact that Caesar symbolized the movement, but it was all these people. One of the things you were telling us before was we were talking about Caesar's ability, especially during the 60s and 70s, to reach out and attract this amazing cross-section of people, kids with genes and
yes,
intellectuals and priests. Talk a little bit about that.
One of the organizing principles was that we learned from Alinsky was never do for others what they can do for themselves. A second principle was the power of the mix. And we really learned the value of engaging others who would share the concerns of your issues, and therefore was easier during the 60s to bring people in. Today, it's very difficult because every cause is hurting. The environmentalists have theirs, and you can take virtually any issue, and Congress has either exacerbated the problem by cutting.
So in the 60s, what was the mix? Who did he attract?
He attracted very early...
Sorry, I forgot. Caesar attracted.
CSER attracted persons who had been in the CSO movement, so it was a community-based attraction. I mean, it didn't start with Fred Ross and an Anglo. It was basically going to people like Gil Padilla and others who had been involved. Secondly, he was able to attract people of goodwill like Chris Hartmeyer from the religious faith. He was able then to bring in the artists, Louis Valdez, and he was the Teatro Campesino and so on. But he also brought in young people from New York, and all kinds of folks came in. I remember when I was asked to head up the Delano Strike Assistance Committee in San Francisco, we engaged the Longshoremen's Union and all of the various progressive people of the city that used to send car caravans to Delano, and they were welcome there. So it was an incredible array of folks that led to a strengthening that early beginning that CSER had.
Now, as we move into the 90s, the cycles are coming around, and the issues are sort of the same. Have they ever changed? Are they the same as when you started?
In 1965, Ernesto Galarza and Julian Zamora and I were asked by the Ford Foundation to go into the Southwest to find out what the critical issues were that were facing our people. What we found was that in the Southwest, there was no one overriding issue. Clearly, farm workers was an issue, but so was urban poverty, so were police issues, the dropout problem. In almost any community you went to, there were critical issues that plagued us then and plague us now. For example, the lack of visibility in the media. Someone described the phenomenon as if we looked into a mirror and didn't see ourselves. We still lack visibility nationally and through the media, except for this program, of course. But the main is that many of those problems are still there. In fact, Galarza used to say that the problems, given the numbers, may become so big that it'll be beyond the capability of some institutions to deal with that. Look at our prisons, look at the welfare rolls. On the downside, there are many negatives with respect to intractable, persistent poverty, but yet there are a lot of positives that have happened since then. But still, until the people left behind are taken care of, we haven't really succeeded.
But I mean, the IDF folks are going back to citizenship classes and voter registration?
Yes. I think there is a valuable lesson to be learned by the fact that by organizing, as we did in the 50s, that we will then generate a new level of leadership, and who knows how many Cesar Chavez's are in that mix.
When you look back at what Cesar accomplished, what do you think his legacy is? What has he left us?
Well, for the living, certainly a generosity of spirit, an example and a model of a very caring person. And considering the spirituality of Cesar, I think that we could say that he was indeed a very effective servant, and he has given us the courage to be and to do, and we have to remember to keep alive the sacrifices he made, because building a movement isn't about starting and stopping, it's about continuing. The gains you make at a movement can surely be lost. For example, we need to be sure that as we move forward as a people, that we are as compassionate and caring about other groups, other people. That just because we have been left out and made invisible, we have to be much more inclusive and caring so that the legacy of Chavez lives on, and I think that's what he gave us.
You used the word sacrifice. That's a particularly important word for what he did and what organizers do, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I'm not sure that Cesar could have accomplished what he did without sacrifice. I'm not sure that any movement can really be a movement unless people are willing to sacrifice, are willing to die if necessary for change, for positive change. And there's no holiday when you're fighting injustice, and Cesar was at it all the time, 7 days a week. I remember one time how much he really enjoyed a dinner we had. It was a Diet Cola and some vegetarian Chinese food. He thought he was in heaven. And so one has to learn to enjoy the environment of the pressures, to be grateful and thankful for the wonderful friends you make, for those moments when maybe the best you've got is something like a cola and wonderful vegetarian Chinese food. I mean, that's a blessing. And Cesar was able to enjoy those blessings.
I have a feeling that sometimes he did his best under pressure. Do you think that's true?
Yes, he did. And
in a complete sense, Caesar did his best.
Caesar did his best under great pressure. He was unnerved, at least appeared to be unnerved, when he confronted very hostile, difficult situations. But the warm smile and the expressive eyes became very deliberate when he confronted somebody in authority. He never had to worry about Caesar getting lost, or that he had no commitment, or that he had weakened his commitment. He was remarkable and tenacious. And I guess if I had to describe him in one way, it's that Caesar never asked anyone to do anything that he wouldn't do, or that he would ask anyone to do more than he was willing to do. And in fact, so oftentimes I think the unwritten principle of an organizer is to do more and make the others feel guilty, and you'll pick up a good share of activism. So Caesar, by his example, I think maybe made some people feel they weren't working hard enough. And believe me, the people around him worked very, very hard all the time.
And you really couldn't keep up with Caesar, could you?
No, I think that anybody who, I can think of Dolores and Huerta and a few others, Gil Padilla and a few others who also worked very hard, and somehow I think they need to be enshrined in this. But in the main, a person who is moving as the elected leader of a movement must be prepared to do more. I just don't think you can say, I'll do only half as much as the people I'm working with. I think it's the nature of leadership is to always try to do more, sometimes even more than you think you're capable of doing or of giving. But again, Caesar, I think, was able to do that because Helen Chavez and his family support system were always there for him. And I think as we think about doing anything, we need to take a look and reassess our family connections, our support system, because it can get awfully lonely out there. It can get awfully hostile. People think you're doing this only for fame or for money or for some other ulterior motive. And I remember before Caesar was a household name, Chicanos asking me, well, who is this guy Chavez? He's only in this thing for this or for that, or is he communist? All kinds of names. But then when he was discovered by the New York Times, you know, then, of course, there were many people who thought they had discovered Caesar and were quite willing to help. But the fact of the matter is, Caesar grows on you over time, and I think, as I think about him, and I do, I still think of Caesar in so many different ways, and I think of it fondly to think how fortunate I was to have had this opportunity to work with such a great human being.
Okay, that was take six.
How did people's lives change over in the field? Was Caesar able to actually make a better life for farm workers?
Caesar was able to improve the well-being of farm workers by, first of all, giving them dignity and giving them hope. Caesar was able to provide tangible benefits to those workers that succeeded in getting contracts. Caesar also provided the kind of training and leadership for a new generation of farm workers. I think those who are now running the farm labor movement are products of that. So he has left a legacy. He has also left a legacy in the cities for young people who desperately need role models, who need to know that you can make a difference, and to be able to look to Chavez and others like Caesar to say, I can do it too.
Si se puede.
Si se puede.
How much are you at?
30.
We're trying to do one more question on this.
This is going to be this last question, I think, is significant.
Okay, that was take seven. Take eight's next.
This done well. You comfortable?
Oh, yes.
Okay, we're now going to camera roll 97. Our next take will be take 8.
Gouveia. She said, oh, well, Tony finally left. And I said,
really?
Kidding? Do tell.
What is happened? That right?
What happened? She said, well, there was some big confrontation between Tony and whoever's the treasurer. And Tony got up before the executive board and said, it's him or it's me. And they said,
how
it's
interesting.
Him.
How interesting.
Can you believe it? I mean, after what, 40 years?
Yes, yes, yes. Tony used to get so angry at Caesar and I that he'd be standing there and he'd be shaking.
Well, see, we tried to talk to him, I guess, last year. We called him looking for old photographs. He just blew up us over the phone. He wouldn't talk about Caesar and Dolores is a red. And just, you know.
Oh,
why
was a shame.
Is he so angry?
Well, you know, first of all, let me say in fairness to Tony, he never really took anything for himself. You know, he never used his position to get an appointment or anything like
that.
Yeah, he never used his position to advance himself. And I don't know whether he, deep down inside, felt that everybody else was benefiting off of the labor of the organization or of what his, you know, he had contributed. And the other is, I think, frankly, and I'm disappointed in that response, but it may be true. Is that Tony just liked power and liked to hold on to it, that he just had no ability to share it and to see that by developing others that, you know, that's your crowning jewel. I mean, you rejoice when you say, I had something to do with maybe influencing Caesar's direction, which Tony, I'm sure, did in some ways. Mm-hmm. He was a tough trade unionist who knew all the rules. And
what union had he been
with? He was with the steelworkers. I remember he was pushing Symington for president one year. But he used to get so angry at us. In fact, I remember times when I'd go to the office in L.A. and Tony would be there, and Tony's sister Ursula would be here, and Caesar would be over there typing. And
this is sort of going back over some stuff, but it's an important point. We haven't talked about it much. You were talking about Caesar's effect on the Chicano movement, especially, and you talked about his fasts. And I think the fasts and what he was willing to do, especially in 68, were very, very important. What do you think that meant? What was it about?
Caesar's commitment for change by this time was influenced by a lot of the reading that he did. I think in the spirituality of his development was clear to me. When I knew Caesar, he was influenced, I think, initially by people like Father McDonald and other of the mission band that I mentioned. But we talked about the encyclicals. Which are very powerful lessons for us to examine in terms of labor and capital and the rights of workers and refugees and immigrants and so on. And I think those had an effect. When we met with Alinsky, Caesar read at Saul's recommendation books about power, about Machiavelli and de Tocqueville, about democracy. And Caesar read, became an avid reader. And over the years, it seemed to me Caesar became, I think, concerned about the movement and the style of leadership and became convinced that nonviolence was a lesson that had to be practiced and taught by example. And again, as I have mentioned, Caesar never asked anyone to do something that he wouldn't be willing to do, including putting himself on the line.
But what happened in 68 was really his way of focusing the movement on nonviolence, wasn't it?
On nonviolence, but also to...
I need a complete sense.
We need to look at the fast in terms of what Caesar was doing first, not as a religious symbol, but rather to make sure that the farm workers themselves did not get frustrated and return violence with violence. And it was also a very effective way by which Caesar could focus on the plight of the workers. For the first time, there seemed to be some stirring on the part of the national media that here was a story about a person who was doing some very remarkable things. I'm not sure that Caesar woke up one day and said, well, I ought to go on national television. I think what happened was the inevitable consequence of doing something very humanistic, something very dramatic that caught the public's attention, plus the visitations of the Kennedys and the trade unionists, the pilgrimage of great people to Caesar. Helped to give that movement greater credibility than it ever had before. And so the symbolism that surrounded Caesar was not Catholic, it wasn't Gandhian per se, it was a mix of a very ecumenical movement built on solid organizing principles.
I mean, and the grower's response was, well, that's just a cheap trick to get publicity.
That's always the case when someone begins to show signs of gaining strength, is to try to discredit it and trying to pass it off as a sideshow or circus and so on. But the more they did that, the more it added to Caesar's credibility. And Caesar was a remarkable genius in his own right. We give a lot of credit to Fred and to Saul Alinsky and to others. But remember, Caesar by this time had matured as an organizer in his own right. He had organized CSO chapters in Oakland and in the Valley, and certainly had learned the art of organizing himself and added his own embellishments to it.
Okay, that was take 8.
Let me go back again over the fact that while clearly there were many, many issues during the 60s that now had burst forth on the Chicano scene and at times on the national scene. The frustration on the part of some of the activists was that somehow Caesar wasn't cooperating or participating in the walkouts or in the marches or in the efforts to achieve a specific goal that someone had in mind. It's not that Caesar was unfriendly, but Caesar had a goal. He said, look, if we're going to build a union, I've got to focus and concentrate on that. And for many years, Caesar, it wasn't a matter of isolation, but the priority was clearly focused. But as you look at it, there was a lot more cooperation than meets the eye, and Caesar was always at least giving signals to people that he endorsed that or was helpful and was cooperating. But in the main, the issues that were in the Latino community were so many you couldn't even begin to keep track of them, whether it be the blowouts, the student rebellions, or the Tijerina thing, or the Corky Gonzalez in Denver, the La Raza Unida in Texas, and Paso in Texas, and MAPA, and then the other things at CSO. For the first time, we see a plethora of activity, all of it constructive and some of it on the edge, that you would just simply spend your time going to one meeting after the other. But Caesar, I think to his credit, said, no, let me concentrate on this. You know, what you're doing is a good thing. He never condemned it, but said, look, I've got to get my priorities straight. And I think there is a lesson in that for all of us, too, that we can't spread ourselves so thin as to not be effective. And so I clearly there was a voice of frustration from time to time of why Caesar wasn't involved and that sort of thing, but I think he was right.
Because the students said, well, we are the movement. The student movement right. is the movement. And someone else said, Raza Unida is the movement. But looking back, we can see that they really were all together.
Yes, they were through informal and more formal channels of communication, and clearly if we're going to achieve any significant impact on some of the remaining issues going forward into the next millennium, there's got to be continued collaboration, cooperation on the part of all the organizations. But as Monsignor O'Grady said when he was helping us through the Industrial Areas Foundation, we must continue to pump up new life from the bottom, new leadership from the bottom, and that's what I think will do it for us.
All right.
Okay.
So has the last word. Oh, yeah, we have to be quiet for a minute. We need to do a little sound recording.
Okay, this will be room tone for the interview with Herman Gallegos.
Room saw, is the chainsaw on plane?
Be quiet.
Okay, that's the end of room tone, the end of the interview with Herman Gallegos, and the end of this sound room. Goodbye. Okay, that's the end of the interview with Herman Gallegos.
Yeah.
The end of the sound roll. Goodbye.